This is the New Glarus Brewing Podcast with Dan Carey. I am Scott May. I'm here with Dan this week. How are you doing, Dan?
I'm doing all right. How about you, Scott?
You know what? It's weird. I woke up in just like a fantastic mood today.
Well, you have to take the good with the bad.
You know, when you, I kind of feel like when you realize like, oh, I'm in a really good mood, then it's like, okay, hold on to that. You got to enjoy that for a little bit.
Well, the trick is to remember it so that when you're in a bad mood, you do understand that it's only a mood and it doesn't reflect the world as a whole.
You know what? That is a solid bit of advice. I'm gonna store this. This is why I like talking to you. This is why I treasure these half hour, 45 minutes every day, because you drop some pearls of wisdom on me.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
Yeah, I'm going with it. I think other people would agree with that too.
Yeah, well, thanks.
I'm excited this week, and I know at least one Wisconsin beer writer in our great state who will be excited when this episode comes out. Because we have a return of a beer that sort of became a fan favorite really quickly, but and was around for a couple of years, and then it took a year off last year. We have Kid Kolsch coming back, and this can we have right here is sort of fresh off the line, right?
Yep.
Well, again, with the cans you guys are putting out, this one, I'm looking at it, and this can is awesome. I love the silver, like where the thumbprint cans have like sort of the line of black around it. This has a nice like line of silver around the top, and just a gorgeous looking can.
Well, Deb really hit it out of the park with this because she wanted them to be unique, so not to look like everybody else's cans. Most times, manufacturers, brewers, or anybody in the food business will try to copy whatever the zeitgeist is, whatever people are doing at that time. So everything kind of looks the same when you look down a row of beer. But she wanted our beer to stand out and look unique and different, to have a happy mood, not to be, you know, there's no devils or monsters on the label. It's they're cheerful, forward looking, and also the family of cans or bottles should have a uniformity so that you recognize it as a New Glarus product, but it's unique from the competition.
Yeah. So it's essentially like whatever your aesthetic you're going for, you know, kind of stick with it.
Well, and it also has to stick out. It has to look, so you have, when you walk down the aisle, you have to say that's a New Glarus beer.
For sure. And I think some people like, you know, there would be like a want to like change things up. Oh, if this isn't working, but if you do form a cohesion in your products, you form a story around what people are consuming. They can identify with it, and
That's right. Like the Budweiser bow tie or the Coca-Cola red, you know, those are all iconic.
Oh, for sure. And I'm going to go ahead and crack this can, cause it has been legitimately over a year since I've had a Kid Kolsch. And one of the things about this beer and this style of beer is that I don't really know altogether that much about Kolsch, where it comes from, its sort of history, how you came up with the recipe for this particular one. And, you know, I think above all else, why do you think this particular iteration of a Kolsch sort of struck a chord with the beer drinkers in Wisconsin?
Yeah, well, that's kind of a takes a while to explain all that, but I can tell you that a Kolsch is a person or a thing from the city of Cologne, Germany.
Okay.
So it's a Kolsch style. Obviously, we're in New Glarus, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
But a Kolsch is a, as I said, or food or a person or something from the town of Köln. Or in English and French, it's called Cologne. And Cologne is a major city on the Rhine River. I think it's 2,000 years old. It was settled by the Romans, and it was called Colonia or Colony.
Oh, okay.
And so it was a Roman colony. And the name morphed into Köln in German or Cologne in French. And so we Americans have adopted, the English speakers have adopted the name Cologne.
Gotcha.
But the beer is called a Kolsch style beer. And certainly in the old days, 400 years ago, the type of beer they were making were top fermented ales. And we've talked about what that means.
Yeah. You gave me a very good education on why it's called top fermented. I really appreciated that.
So they're top fermented beers. Then as years went by and lager beer became more and more popular, the small breweries of the city of Cologne were under pressure. And because lager beer was taking the world by storm. So there was a local resistance against these interloper lager beers, and they kind of stuck to their guns making top fermented beer. And in the early 1900s, about right after World War One, I believe, they passed a law that basically said in the city of Cologne, when you make a Kolsch style of beer, it has to be brewed in the city of Cologne. It has to be made with top fermented yeast, and it has to follow certain things. Mm-hmm. But it is a top fermented, but it's lagered. So it's a top fermented yeast, but then it's aged like a lager beer. And it's pale in color, like a pale lager beer. So it was Cologne's answer, the small breweries of Cologne's answer to making a competition for lager beer. So that style of beer was adopted by American brew pubs and small breweries to make this style of beer. And it morphed in America with the craft brewing revolution into being just simply a way to compete. When people came into a brew pub and they said, I don't want a pale ale or a stout or a porter.
Yeah.
Do you have something that tastes like Miller or Bud? And so people would come out with this Cologne beer. But this Kolsch beer is a, it's not a big beer. It's not dark. It's not rich. It's not bitter. It's an easy drinking, somewhat fruity beer.
Yeah.
This is, and it's mostly clear. They're clear like a lager, like a Pilsner would be.
Yeah.
But also unfiltered or hazy versions are made. And they're called white beers, white Cologne beers.
Gotcha.
Or in the Cologne dialect, it's spelled not like a Bavarian style Weissbier, but it's Weiss as opposed to EI. So it's, I would pronounce it a Weiss beer, but I don't know how they pronounce it in Cologne. They have their own dialect. And so this beer is modeled after the Cologne style, unfiltered, hazy, Kolsch style. And we tried to brew in the traditional way that you would find in a small brewery in the city of Cologne. There's a handful of breweries, iconic breweries.
Yeah.
So I visited these breweries and emulated some of the traditional German ways of brewing this type of beer. It's made with all noble hops. It's made with a double decoction. It's made in open fermenters. A lot of the things that I've talked about before that I find in iconic European style beers.
So yeah.
It's its own unique animal, fruity, malty, a little bit more bitter than say Spotted Cow. So there's plenty of bite to it and a little bit of haze. And it's broadly in the Cologne style or Kolsch.
Well, I'm taking my first sort of few sips here and, you know, hearing you describe it and then tasting it, like right off the bat on the nose, it's like, you know, you're getting into a beer flavored beer, right?
Yeah.
But then you take your sip and you're absolutely right. There is that there seems to be a bitterness on it that is really quite pleasant. And it really sort of hits my palate very, very nicely. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't overwhelm, but it's very subtly complex, which is something I keep coming around to and saying about your beers is like, you tend to have something where, you know, you explain it as, this is this simple product that is meant to do these things. And then you taste it and you see how it's done all those things, but you seem to layer on this complexity within these very simple styles of beer that I just find very admirable.
Well, thank you. It's not meant to be hit you over the head. It's not, you know, it's not like an IPA. It's not meant to be you know, malty, like a Helles. It's meant to be light and delicate and easy drinking, not as aromatic, hoppy aromatic, nor as bitter as a Pilsner. Kind of exists in its own world, inspired by Pilsners, but it's its unique own easy drinking beer. And it's usually, if you go to a brew pub in Cologne and you drink this beer, it's meant for drinking in sessions. They drink it in small glasses, little tiny, thin walled glasses. And the glasses are small so that the beer stays cold.
Mm-hmm.
And the bartenders come around and are constantly giving you more of this beer until you put your beer coaster on top of the glass saying, I'm enough. I've had enough. But it's a social beer. It's not meant to really think too much about. It's meant to sit around the table and talk about football or politics or whatever, you know, people do in bars.
Oh yeah, we just get deep into politics and religion. That's where I go. Just go straight for God, and politics in the bar.
Yeah, right. After a couple of beers.
Well, a couple of interesting things that you had mentioned. I love getting into the histories of sort of these beers. You know, when you went down to Argentina and you have those Argentinian, like, you know, barbecue places, it's basically like, we are going to serve you meat until you tell us to stop.
That's a Super Bowl of meat right there.
Yeah. Well, it seems like this beer has a similar sort of cultural space in Cologne.
It does.
I think that's
they're
really
big beer halls. And, you know, beer is a serving beer, is important. Like in Paris, when you think about, say, French bread, it's serious business. You don't screw around with people's, French bread, baguettes, in Cologne. It's the same way with beer. It's not that people dwell on it or think too much of it. It's like the air you breathe. Just accept it. But it's important.
And there's a way of doing it.
Oh, yeah.
So why Kid Kolsch? Like, because naming conventions for beers, I find very interesting. And I really enjoy the way you guys come up with your names. And, you know, I've talked about it before. I think the iconography of this brewery is just, you know, top notch. Hard to find a brewery out there that's doing a better job just of coming up with sort of icons for their beer. And, you know, I understand sort of the play on words. It has, you know, the sheep, or is it a goat or a sheep?
That's a goat.
It has a goat on it, and it's called Kid Kolsch. So I get like sort of the pun there, but is there a reason why that name sort of stuck around?
So when we come out with a new beer, and this beer came out, I think in 2021, maybe. When we come up with an idea for a beer, it may come from sales, it may come from me, may come from Deb, may come from somebody in the brewery. I don't remember where the idea for this beer came from. But so now we have an idea. And so Deb will then start to ruminate on how are we going to market it? Mm-hmm. And so she'll start thinking of names, and maybe, you know, that rumination goes on for some days or weeks, and she'll, you know, kick around some names and say to people and see how they respond. And if they say, or if they laugh, because normally we try to make whimsical names that are fun.
Yeah.
Not too seriously or not irreverent. And so she was ruminating us on this idea, and we were up in, Door County, and, we were in, oh gosh, where were we? Sister Bay or Fish Creek. And there is there's a small little like ice cream parlor, and they sell goat cheese, and it's down from Husby's.
Oh yeah.
And so we were walking around in the summer, and they at this little boutique deli, they were associated with a farm that had goats, milked goats. So they had out in front a small enclosure, wire enclosure, with a couple of baby goats, kids in it. And if you've ever been around goats, they have a lot of personality, and young.
Oh, yeah.
Baby goats are really cute and just lovable and playful and whimsical. And they butt heads, and they jump up and down, and they like to climb on top of things. And goats to me are a lot like dogs. They're just nice people. And so, Deb was thinking about this name, and we're near the goats and petting the goats. And, Deb says, what about the name Kid Kolsch? I said, oh, that's great. That's really great. So she hand drew the little kid goat on the label. That's a hand drawing. It's not like traced, or it's just freehand drawn.
Yeah, there's no AI programs running your labels.
No, nor, you know, sometimes people will project up onto a wall and trace it. Or,
yeah.
But no, she actually drew that. She's really good at drawing things anatomically correct. It's a real talent to make. And in fact, one of the things that really bugs her when there's art with like a person or a horse that's, you know, not proportional.
Yeah.
And to draw something in a proportional way is, in my experience, is I can't do it.
No, but me neither. Does it.
But in any event, so she made this goat. It's, I guess you could say it's somewhat, you know, somewhat related to Spotted Cow, because Spotted Cow has a jumping calf. Mm-hmm. On it. So this is similar to that. But the name Kid Cole, she had a nice, it rolled off the tongue, and it was fun.
Yeah.
Because we have lots of animal beers. Lots of our beer, you know.
Oh, yeah. Staghorn.
Staghorn. Spotted Cow. Yeah. Moon Man is named after a cat, as we've said. So it just seemed like a logical extension and fun.
Well, and when you have a beer and you a beer that is well made and true to the vision you wanted, and then it marries really well with a name and an icon, yeah. You know, really good things can happen from yeah. that. And you're sort of talking about this beer, and it's like, oh, you know, it's, you know, not, it's not going to beat you over the head with hops. It's not going to, you know, it's, you know, it's not going to be the huge flavorful bomb stouts that are out there. But in a world that's inhabited by a lot of those beers, were you at all surprised by the love that Kid Kolsch got, like right off the bat? Because it seemed like when this beer came out, like the next day, I think there was like two review articles about it. Just like, holy crap, New Glarus has made one of the best Kolsches around.
Yeah, it is. Well, of course, it's flattering and it's fun. But really, I don't really understand. There's really no formula to make a hit song that I know of.
Yeah.
Especially when you're trying to be true to who you are. And we don't try to brew beers that are going to meet a whatever is happening currently, whatever is hot. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that can be problematic because maybe it takes time for customers to wrap their head around it. So maybe it takes a long time for a beer to become accepted. So sometimes it doesn't work. But in this case, I don't know why, but it did work. Cause there's, it's all about subtleties, and subtleties, nuances are kind of something that's, it's not a formula. You can't plug a recipe into a formula and produce a winning beer. There's nuances, some that are maybe not so easy to see, that are not clear. And so then once you make a winner, then the trick is to do it next time.
Do it. Now do it again.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm looking at this beer, and you're right, that haziness is very clearly there. Like, you can see through it, but there's a nice sort of opaqueness to it, and it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous beer. And I for one am really just stoked that it is back in cans, and the whole thing just looks really, really cool.
It kind of has that kind of Chardonnay glow to it, luminous character. It's not pale, but it's blonde.
Yeah, it really is. And when you said, you know, when you sort of compared it to Pilsners and stuff like that, like, I can really pick that up in here, where it's like, you know, a lot of times when people hear, oh, it's an easy drinking beer, they get a mental image in their head of like, you know, oh, I can just pour this sort of down my throat and won't even notice it, you know. But this is one of those beers where, even though, you know, you can certainly tag it with an easy drinking tag. It really is. But it does make you stop and think while you're drinking it, because there's so much else going on with it. It's really cool.
Well, I always feel that and I've said before, you want, if you're going to invest the calories in drinking a can of beer and the, you know, 5% alcohol is not much alcohol, but you want to make sure that it's worth your investment.
You're getting the bang for your buck out of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we were sort of talking before this, and one of my favorite things is like your life in this brewery is just hectic. There's always something to go alongside or going on. So you're like, I don't know what you're talking about. So what are you doing this week?
Yeah.
And then you started just sort of rattling off the things that were going on. So one of the things that we've sort of hit on, but I don't think we've ever really like explored, is you guys have been doing a fairly involved project in your cellar that I don't fully understand, but I'm very interested in, because when I see like the IT department and the cellar department, and like you are very excited about
and
something.
And welders.
And then I see miles of stainless steel and computers open in the brew hall. I know something cool is sort of going on. Can you sort of elaborate on what that project was, and is it finished? Is it going? Like how is the cellar project going?
Yeah, it's more or less one third done. It's a 3-year project.
Gotcha.
And the work is being done over the winter, so not to compromise summer production. And the first stage is done. We have so when we say cellar, that's an old word referring to the cold area of the brewery. So there's the hot area, the copper brew kettles where we do the cooking. And then there's the cold area where the malt extract, the wort, is turned into beer, which is a multi-week process. And then the third stage is packaging that into cans, kegs, or bottles. So this is the middle area, and it's brewers refer to it as the cold section or the cellar. And so there are tanks, big tanks. And there are 36 of them in 3 cellars, so cellar 1, 2, and 3. And those tanks are connected by a series of pipes and sensors, temperature sensors, flow meters, empty signals, et cetera, et cetera. Empty sensors, I mean. So there has to be pipes to supply the wort going in and beer going out. Then there's for CO2, there's CO2 pipes, there's exhaust pipes for the fermentation gas that comes off the top that's saved and collected and compressed and reused. There's cleaners, detergents that have to wash the tanks after they're done. There's what we call Kroisen line, which we would transfer a beer from one tank to another beer. So there are lots and lots. Every tank has lots of pipes supplying them in and out. So every tank is hooked into that matrix by what we call a swing bend. And that swing bend is a C-shaped piece of pipe that allows you to go from the tank to any one of those pipes. So depending on what process is being done, you're cleaning the tank, you're pumping wort in, you're pumping beer out, you're venting gas off the tank. All of those things require a swing bend. And what that means is the operators, the brewers, they go into the cellar and they move that, they close hand valves and they move that swing bend around to allow different operations to occur. And about 2 years ago, I went to the brew house team, and as I do from time to time, and sat them all down and said, how are you folks doing? What are things that we could do better? What would help you to be more successful in your job, to make you more efficient or make better glasses of beer? They came out with probably about 20 things. And one of them was, when we are working in the brew house and we are pumping wort from the whirlpool tank, from the hot section to the cold section, we have to walk out into the cellar and we have to do a swing bend, move the pipe. So what's what we call set up a path.
Yeah.
And then go back to the control room and start the pump. That is an action that, you know, is going to take them 15 minutes of time. And they do that, you know, multiple times in a shift. And they said it would be nice if we could automate that, because, for example, the person on the Dan Reynolds, who we're blessed works the midnight shift, he's there by himself. except for a guard. There's usually somebody there to make sure that, you know, nothing happens to him.
And then Dan will have to, you want Dan having to take care of an intruder or something.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and also to make sure that he's safe.
Yeah.
But be that as it may, he said it would be really nice if I could do that with the automated valves. And I said, oh my God, you guys, that is a major undertaking. But the more I thought about it, I thought that if we could make the setting of the path an automated step that the brewers could do remotely, it would save them lots and lots of steps. The automation of the process allows them to be more powerful so that they, moving the swing bend, it's not the end of the world, but you're carrying a wrench in your back pocket. Mm-hmm. You're walking in the cellar, and the cellar's fairly big. So you have to walk out, you have to set the path, you have to make sure that you set it correctly. And it is a physical action mm-hmm. that is best done by a young person. So if I have somebody who we hired when they were 22 years old, and now they're 40, 50, 60, if we can minimize those repetitive ergonomically costly movements, we would benefit by keeping these people. Secondly, they would be more powerful because they could get more work done. They can multitask using computers. Therefore, they're more valuable to the brewery. They can be paid more. So it's a win-win situation. We're more efficient. Their backs aren't being abused, and they're making more money. So this state-of-the-art automation using matrices, pipe matrices with automated valves, allows us to do a lot of things in an automated way. And in fact, the dream is that we'll be able to do cleaning of the pipes overnight in an automatic way, in what the Germans call lights out brewing, that there's physically nobody there.
Yeah.
And from time to time, an error occurs and the computer will call somebody. And then a maintenance tech and a brewer will have to come in and fix the problem. But that's a very rare occurrence.
Yeah.
The idea is that this Hilltop Brewery is now, 2007 to 2024. So we are setting this up so that this cellar design will allow us to move forward for the next 50 years. The future of brewing is making the absolute highest quality you can in the most efficient way that you can. You can't be wasteful.
Yeah. Resources just aren't allowing for it. And
no,
yeah,
no resources in all ways, whether it's water, electricity, heat, labor. Mm-hmm. We talk a lot about sustainability is a buzzword around environmental issues, and it is a noble and true issue, but sustainability also speaks to the people and the culture, that the people have to be sustained over the long haul. And if you have somebody who's really talented and knows their way around the cellar and is a perfectly talented brewer, you want them to be able to continue to work up to retirement without mm-hmm. difficulty, because if knees start to suffer or back start to suffer, it's costly. It's costly for the brewery. It's costly for the individual. It's costly for the individual's family. So this is a home run. The problem is that it's really, really complicated.
It sounds like it.
Miles of pipe, miles of wire, lots of code being written. And there's three cellars, and then our cleaning systems and water systems. So this one was cellar one and two. Next year, we're going to do cellar three. We'll do it over the winter. So it's a step-by-step process, but it's been going on all winter. And this week we, started up the system, and the first tank, there's always some sort of glitch or drama.
Yeah.
And, but it went swimmingly, which is rare. So everybody was very happy. And I think part of the reason is we have really, really talented people. Chris Heiberger led the design team. Chad Zarzynski worked with our programmers. Tony Severson and the welders, Rukti Stainless Welding, Clark Electric, which is a local electrical company, all of our brewers who were on the design team. And probably the reason why it was so successful is I let them run without me. I gave them a 10,000-foot view of what I want this cellar to do. And they actually improved what I would want. So I think we've grown to the point where I'm proud to say that I can hand the baton off to the next generation as far as engineering and construction projects, which is really a proud moment for me.
I was going to say, that's got to be a great feeling for you.
Yeah.
Both from like a personal standpoint of like, wow, I've come to a good understanding in just my life and my career where, you know, I've earned the right to have people executing my vision. And then also knowing that you've made such good decisions in the people that you've brought along and sort of mentored in whether it's in brewing the actual beer, whether it's in cellaring the actual beer, or whether it's in like the maintenance and technical aspect of building a brewery that works and works well, you know, knowing you've executed those things to the point where, you know, your people around you are just getting so much better, has to feel just so good.
Oh yeah. They're way beyond my skill set. You know, when the brewery was first starting, and it was basically a pump and a couple of hoses and dragging them around, and it was, you know, me starting and shutting off a pump by hand.
Yeah, cursing that stuff, like, why is this so heavy? Like,
yeah. Well, when you're young, that's not really such a problem. But I went from a time of, I'll you know, get on my way, I'll do it myself, I don't trust anybody, to the now, it's been a, you know, journey to the point where I know that I implicitly trust them. I know that they will do a better job than I would. And the probably the overriding feeling is a feeling of security and confidence. And that is supplants the fear of letting go. And that's a process that anybody goes through that starts a business. I mean, you know, Deb's the one who started the business, but I mean, I was the first employee.
You were there.
That to go from that feeling of I'm going to do it myself because I want it done right, to the point where you have a crew of people that are spectacularly brilliant is a it's not an easy journey, and a lot of people can't make that.
Yeah.
But I think so it is a proud moment.
Well, and I, the other part in your explanation of what it is, and I this is one of the other things I just absolutely love about the way sort of your mind works, because I would have had the same reaction. Like, you know, no one's going to come to me and be like, you know, I need to fix a swing or whatever, but the swing bend or I want to figure out a way to automate this. But whenever someone brings something to me that's like, that seems like it's going to be a huge undertaking, like my first impulse is to be like, oh man, geez, I don't know. That sounds rough. That sounds like it's going to be a lot of work over a lot of time. But then I sort of do a similar thing where if it's something that's a good idea and you know it is, and the only thing that's sort of hung up on is like the amount of work it'll take to get the good idea done. Like, it seems like your mind just chews on that for a little while. And then all of a sudden you start solving the little problems in your head to where you convince yourself into like, oh, well, now I have it. You know, now I know 90% of how we would do it, and then you execute it. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But it's bigger than that, because when the idea for a simple when the brew house team said, can we have automated valves for just part of the cellar? And when I started to ruminate on that, I realized that that really wasn't feasible. It was either all in or not. All in, though, was extremely expensive.
Yeah.
The other thing was the cellar as it existed was not broken. It was working perfectly well.
Yeah.
And to do this work was incredibly disruptive and incredibly expensive. So when I started to first broach the subject with the brewers, because you know, we said many times in these podcasts that we work in a collaborative way. So I get all of everybody together, from the newest hire to the most senior person, say, this is what I'm thinking. Most of them, I would say the majority, were against it.
Oh, why? Really?
Yeah, because it ain't broke.
Oh,
why?
Yeah.
Why would we do this? Because it ain't broke.
Oh, I'm highly sympathetic because I am so change adverse.
Yeah, most people are.
Yeah.
But there were a few, opinion leaders were like, no, I hear you. I understand what you're saying, Dan. You're not looking for tomorrow or next year or 5 years. You're looking 30 or 50 years down the road. So I get it. But the person that I had to sell on the idea was Deb, because Deb is the one that manages the budget.
Yep.
And this, and also the direction the brewery goes in. And this is an extremely, extremely expensive project. The second most expensive project we've ever undertaken in the brewery, and the second most complex project. So I was able to articulate that it would allow us to run in overnight on lights out. It would allow us to take care of our brewers. Then Deb said, it's worth me spending the money. To give you an idea, some years ago, we still do, but a lot of our beer goes into draft.
Yeah.
So, our keg line is running at, 120 kegs an hour. So we're spitting out lots and lots of kegs. And when the line first started, those kegs were hand stacked.
Yep.
And a beer is very, very heavy. So when you are the operator on the end of the line, you are double stacking those kegs, one a minute or two every minute.
Oh yeah. They don't just stop coming off the line.
Exactly.
When you need a break.
Okay. There was a vacuum assist that helped, that did the lifting, but you still had to move your shoulders, still had to put this suction cup on the keg and lift it up. It was assisted, so you weren't lifting all of the weight. So it wasn't as bad as I sound. But nonetheless, when you do it for 8 hours, there's a potential for a carpal tunnel issue. So,
well, try doing shoulder shrugs at 10 pounds for 8 hours straight.
Exactly. That's a great analogy. So Deb saw this on the line and realized that we could do this with a robot. The robot doesn't improve the efficiency. We still need an operator, so we still need somebody standing there doing inspections of the kegs and putting labels on the kegs, but they no longer have to touch the kegs. So putting in a robot, which is a relatively expensive undertaking and complicated project, it was worth the investment simply because it protects the health of the people doing the work. And that was absolutely, in Deb's mind, it was a no-brainer.
Oh, like, yeah.
I don't care what it costs. We have to do this, because you can't abuse your employees, because after a few years, they're going to start developing carpal tunnel issues and they're going to have to find a more healthy job and move on. Mm-hmm. That's a really bad situation for everybody. So by doing this robot, the job becomes much more cerebral, much more mental, and it's much, much more peaceful. So people go home at night or at the end of their shift and they can do something.
Oh yeah. They're not just wiped out and tired, like, all right, after my shift, I'm going to eat some dinner and I'm just going to pass out.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. Fall asleep in front of the TV.
But that's really exciting. And I'm, it's just, again, it's just one of those things where it's like, you guys are so forward thinking in how you want this place to run and how you want it to go into the future that, it seems like you're taking every single step you possibly can to make the sustaining this business as much as sustaining a business can be easy as possible going through into the future.
Sure. Well, there are two things. One is, when we envisioned Hilltop, what the Hilltop Brewery was going to be machinery wise, because Deb did the outsides of the building and the gift shop and all of those things, but how the brewery equipment was going to be set up, I've seen lots of successful, relatively large craft breweries, and they're more or less large craft breweries, meaning they take the technology, the culture, the way that they're designed, and they just have bigger tanks. What I wanted to do, and I appreciate it that the large breweries allowed for more efficiency and more better use of utilities, better use of raw materials, better flow of labor, and frankly, more consistent beer. So I wanted to build a brewery that was a small version of a large brewery. So I was thinking not as a craft brewer, but thinking as a in, as a large as a real brewery, but making it in a manageable size. So I think that that was probably what drove the design of our brewery.
Well, and that makes a just a terrible amount of sense, right? Like you are you're taking all the best aspects of what a craft brewery is, what it does, what it seeks to preserve and what it seeks to put out, and the quality of the attention to detail that a craft that a successful craft brewery is going to need to have, right?
Sure.
And marrying it with the good ideas that come out of sort of mass produced beer.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? Because, you know, there's no one right way of doing things. And, you know, however anyone feels about macro beer, one thing is for certain. Those guys can put out a lot of beer fairly quickly and fairly consistently.
Well, the other thing that we did is by being so efficient, and we are very efficient, we have for a, you know, 230, 240,000 barrel brewery, we have six salespeople. Really, you know, a similar size brewery might have five or more times that many salespeople.
Yeah.
So we are very fiscally responsible. But what that has allowed us to do is we are not a marketing-led brewery. We're a production-led brewery. So by being very efficient, we can be more adventurous in our purchasing of raw materials. So we're not fighting to the bottom. We're not looking for the cheapest options. We're looking for the best options, irregardless of the cost. You know, for example, from time to time, someone may call and they'll say, "Hey, I've got a rail car of malt. The manway on the top was leaked a little bit. So some of the malt right around the manway got moldy, but the rest of it's great. The rest of it's great. It got rejected by a large brewer. Would you be interested in buying it? I'll give it to you for a good price." Mm-hmm. No, I'm not interested in buying it. And it flips things backwards. So I view financial success, or shall we say money. Deboy says money is a bad god to have. Don't let money be your god. In other words, don't focus on it. Don't she calls money a tool. It's like a tool that you use to build things or do things, like a hammer or a wrench. I think of money like a cat. If you are constantly saying, "Here, kitty, kitty, kitty," the cat is definitely going to ignore you and you know, turn its nose up to you and walk away. Yep. But if you ignore the cat and focus on what you're doing, I guarantee you that cat is going to come and jump in your lap. My point is that you make the goal to be the best possible beer that you can, highest quality, always striving to make a better beer. If you do that and you do it as efficiently as you can, and don't be wasteful, but don't cut corners, then you will make a product that people are willing to pay for. I always tell the people on the packaging lines that they're out there for 8 hours watching thousands and thousands of cans and bottles or kegs going by. I say, take care with every single one of them. Don't get sloppy, because every single one of those cans is a little jewel. Mm-hmm. Somebody somewhere is going to pay their hard-earned money for that package. And I want each one of them to have a good experience. People buy a case of beer and bring it to their friends out of state, or they have a wedding and they bring a keg, or, you know, people have written, and my son turned 21 and we bought your beer for the party. That's important shit.
That's, you know, that's real life.
That's right. I mean, that to me is a responsibility. I have a responsibility that when somebody drops, it takes, you know, for them to buy a case of our beer, they got to work an hour.
Oh yeah.
So that is a solemn responsibility that I try to instill on our brewers, that be respectful, because each of those will go into the hands of somebody that's trusting us. And if you do, you know, day in and day out, on average, you do a good job, people will respond, and then you can be successful.
Yeah, and
it's different. Yeah. It's backwards.
No, it makes a ton of sense. I was watching this video the other day of a skater named Rodney Mullen, and he's credited with inventing the most skateboard tricks of anybody, right? Just the godfather of the sport. And he basically said, if you are chasing something tangible that you can grab and you can hold, you will always be wanting. If you are chasing something intangible, something you can never really get to, but you can always strive at, you will never feel wanting, because you will always be kind of after that. And it seems like what you're saying, like, you're not chasing, you know, to be the most successful monetary person on the face of the earth. You're chasing having someone's 21st birthday be a good one.
Yes.
You're chasing having someone's wedding be a little bit better.
That's,
you know,
right.
And when you're chasing that sort of thing, you'll find fulfillment in your everyday life, because those are things that you can't really grab and hold. You can't possess it. So you can always feel like you're moving towards it.
Well, Scott, you're 100% correct. That is right. But that also brings up the thing about the universe is you pay. You always pay.
Yeah.
No matter what you do, there's a price. And the price for living that way, and I live that way, so I know that, is that you are never satisfied. And if you're never satisfied, you're never completely happy.
Gotcha.
But that leads to a consistent low-level sense of angst. It does force you to be better. It does force you to, you know, your skateboarder to invent new tricks and to go out on the edge and, you know, maybe break his arm or whatever. But there's going to be glimpses. There's going to be moments of, brilliance.
Oh, yeah.
But most of the time, there's a sense of not good enough, angst.
Yeah.
And that's the cost. I'm not poo-pooing it, what you said, because I live that way. But unfortunately, you know, sometimes people look at success and they think it came easy. That person was an overnight success. No, there's a lot of angst. There's a lot of work that goes into this, and mental consternation and focus and sacrifice.
Oh, 100%. 100%. This has been an awesome conversation. And I love how these conversations start over a beer. This is like my favorite thing to do is crack a beer and then just start, you know, shooting the bull and
pontificating.
And find out where you go. So I've absolutely loved this. We're coming up against our time. We were going to talk about some of the stuff you got going into the tanks, going into the summer. We might have to do that on the next one.
Yeah, there's a lot now, because, you know, it's what we're at the end of, third week of February.
Oh,
so we are filling tanks with lots of summer beers. So all of our iconic summer beers are going into the tanks. The malt's being made for Staghorn, because that's a long lagered beer. You know, there's all of our summer beers. Today we were selecting hop lots for our Pilsner.
That's going to be one we're going to have to talk about for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
For sure. Well, Dan, it is always a pleasure, and this was just amazing.
Yeah, thank you, Scott.
Thank you very much.